I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm at home in Brighton. Elsewhere, not very far away in Brighton, is also my producer, Phil Berman.
It's Hove. You've got to get the distinction.
Oh, God. OK, let me do that again. OK, sorry. Hi, I'm Raphael Baer. You're listening to Politics on the Couch. This week, we're going to be talking about trust. You can trust me, I'm in Brighton, joining me remotely from Hove, and there's a lot of trust between Brighton and Hove, although, yeah, it could go either way sometimes, is the producer, Philip Berman.
So last episode, which, as it happens, was our most popular one to date, we talked a lot about Dominic Cummings and the whole debacle around that. I mean, Dominic Cummings is still there, but that doesn't mean it hasn't had some impact, does it?
What's interesting is that since then, I think what Boris Johnson got very badly wrong over the Cummings thing by defending him and sending cabinet ministers out to defend Cummings is necessarily politicised every subsequent measure they take to in the easing of lockdown. So whether it's the quarantine stuff, which has been, there's a rebellion brewing on the Conservative benches about that, face masks, they've introduced this sort of Cummings quotient of uncertainty about the motive behind why they're doing it. So I think in February, March, even if people weren't inclined to like the Conservative Party or Boris Johnson very much, there was a sense, the cultural sense out there, that the decisions were being motivated probably by the need to stop people catching this awful disease. And now I think once you've tunneled underneath the motive, that foundation of thinking they're doing this for the right reasons, then the trust edifice that you're trying to build on top of that is very shaky and could crumble.
Yes, and since the Cummings thing, it has only got worse, with the head of the UK Stats Authority berating the Health Secretary about the way the government had presented their figures for the number of coronavirus tests that they'd been doing. He said, and I quote, "They appear to be showing the largest number of tests, even at the expense of understanding."
To draw that line in thick red pencil and say you are actually corroding public confidence in numbers at all in your handling of this, by broadly speaking, it's sort of double counting on the test and saying, so what you're saying you are doing in terms of coronavirus testing, it gives an inflated expectation of what the UK government is currently capable of delivering. I don't know how much that reaches a lot of people. I suspect it's something that will definitely stoke up the suspicion and mistrust of people who are already inclined to mistrust the government. There is also this cultural idea, there's that great quote, you know, lies, damn lies and statistics, that somehow, oh, you can prove anything with statistics. This is a cultural trope, if you like. And it's very unfortunate because it is simultaneously true that there's a way of presenting numbers that gets you to a political point you want to make. But also there is a rigor in mathematics that aspires to a level of truth that pretty much no other discipline can claim to reach. And therefore, maths is truer in a way than almost anything that is happening in the sort of more cultural, verbal realms that politics deals in. It actually gets us quite interestingly into what I hope we're going to talk about with our guests this week.
This week's guest is the author and academic Bobby Duffy.
I'm going to make a cup of tea before we get Bobby actually on.
I think so. So you're going to have a cup of tea, and when you come back, on air will be hopefully Bobby, and you'll have your tea. I'm going to get a coffee. So yeah. we'll say bye-bye to the listeners, and we'll see you in a moment, all right?
Yeah.
All right, I'll switch off. All right,
yeah,
bye.
Download this bit. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. In his book, Perils of Perception, he's written about how we're just not that good at making sense of numbers and stats in everyday life. He's Professor of Public Policy at the Policy Institute's King's College London. Before that, he was the MD at the Ipsos Murray Social Research Institute. And during the pandemic, his team have been tracking and analysing how public trust has fluctuated and has just released a report about that with some very interesting findings.
Okay, we're on. Red light on. So you've got this fantastic piece of research that you very kindly shared with us based on a large opinion poll, looking at a shift in the way people are judging the government's handling of the coronavirus crisis. And it introduces these really interesting categories or tribes of voters, if you like. Maybe you could very briskly sketch out for us who these people are and what it is they believe.
Yeah, we wanted to look at how two key aspects right now, how trusting people are in the government and their measures and their views of the health risks from coronavirus interact with each other. And from that analysis, we saw there was three very distinct groups. There are a group we called the trusting, a group we called the dissenting, and a group we've called the frustrated. And one of the key patterns within that is that the trusting and dissenting actually have very similar views of the health risks from the crisis, from the virus. But they have utterly different views, utterly opposing views of their trust levels in government. And what you see when you look at the patterns within that is that's highly related to party and Brexit identities, your chance of being in the trusting group or the dissenting group. And that's a real shift over the course of the virus. When we went into the lockdown measures, we were incredibly unified with 9 in 10 people supporting them. But now on the way out, as the lockdown measures are eased, we're starting to see those old party identity and Brexit identity divisions start to reassert themselves.
And just in terms of the numbers, let's be clear. So that the sort of trusting and the dissenting, as in, you know, the trusting being people who more or less think that the government's doing the right thing, and the dissenting people who are very sceptical. And one of the things that struck me as interesting is they're sceptical up to the level of thinking the government's basically not being honest about the number of people who are dying, which is a very serious accusation to make against the government when you in a democracy, when you think about it. They're about 38% each. So that's just under 80% of people who agree broadly about how dangerous the virus is, but are completely polarised now in terms of whether they think the government's handling it well. Is that, and then as you say, that suggests a re-emergence of preceding political identities. Are those party identities? Are they leave-remain identities? Or is it a mix of both? How does that work out?
That trusting group are three times as likely to be Conservative supporters as than Labour supporters. The dissenting group three times as likely to be Labour supporters than Conservative supporters. And then the leave-remain identities are also quite stark and polarised. So you're twice as likely to be a leave identity if you're trusting, and twice as likely to be a remain identity if you're dissenting. So it's kind of aligning again. I mean, the key point here is it's not completely aligned as yet. So you've still got about 20% of the trusting group who are Labour supporters, and then 20% of the dissenting group who are Conservative supporters. So there's still that sense of, for some, the view of the virus and the risks involved trumps those identities, but it's a relatively small proportion, but it does show it's not completely aligned yet.
It's not that surprising that Labour supporters would mistrust a Conservative government's handling of a crisis, and you can imagine if it were reversed, those positions might just simply be flipped round. What is interesting, I suppose, is that there's a leave-remain element to it, which wasn't that well aligned before last December on party political lines. It might be a little bit more now. But I think some people listening to this might think, really, still leave Remain? I mean, we have literally left the European Union. And also the coronavirus, you'd have to work pretty hard to turn COVID-19 into a European problem, in the sense of to do with the EU institutions. So what is that distinction describing if it's not the question of Britain's membership of the European Union?
Of course, Leave Remain identities are becoming more aligned with party political identities as the parties have become more aligned with the Leave Remain position. So there's an element of that. But I mean, there is a broader point here, which is about the growth of tribal politics and that sense of polarization in the way that America thinks about polarization, where it's become very tribal. And in all the academic literature, there is this theory within polarization, which is called conflict extension, which is effectively you start with one issue or a couple of issues, and then slowly your identity takes over your views of lots of issues or informs your view of lots of issues. And then you've got something that's much more set, much more difficult for people to have conversations across divides on these types of things. And we looked at this in the UK, and we're not there yet. We think there's a lot of discussion in UK media and comment about culture wars in Britain. We've got a new British culture wars, and it's not really like that as yet. We're much less divided on the issues than you might think from just a casual look at the discussion on this or looking at social media. But there's definite potential there for us to talk ourselves into a culture war situation.
Bringing that back to our situation, then Leave Remain, we might not be as far down that journey as the Americans, but one sensed during the Brexit debate, as you say, that we were getting there. What do those Leave Remain tribes as cultural propositions then, separate to the EU issue, describe? And how does that then, would that then feed into whether or not how they feel about the virus and lockdown?
With the Leave identity, there is that strength of view in we're a great country, we can do this on our own, we've got the right answers, we should trust ourselves, that kind of sense of national pride and connection to it. And the Remain perhaps more wider looking and more sceptical about a country doing this on their own. So there's that natural default to a position of we can handle this and we're correct and we can do this. Versus that sense of actually there's a lot to learn from elsewhere and looking more internationally for clues and approaches to things, because we do stand out in some ways in terms of our international approach to that.
I can see the connection there in terms of if you look at what's happening, if you're a Remainer and your information stream, particularly online, was set up, the silo that you climbed into 2016 to 2018, 19 was a very Remainy one. You'd also now be seeing a lot of information about how the UK's death rate is that much worse than it needed to be compared to, say, Greece, which has done very well. And likewise, if you're a Leaver and your information structures are oriented differently, you will just be getting different information. So it's quite hard to disentangle the information flow from what is something else, a cultural thing about how you identify.
This is where confirmation bias, filter bubbles, all of those types of things come into it, is we start to see the world through our own identity. And it's kind of, it's partly very practical points, like you say, about what we actually see, as in who do we follow, what news sources do we look at. But there is also an emotional element to that, in the sense of we all humans tend to look for information that confirms their views and try to dismiss information that disconfirms their views. So we've got that natural capacity, and that is why we see realities, one of the key reasons why we see realities very differently depending on our identity. It's not a case of we can just show people an objective reality and that will change them. It's kind of much more tied up in how we see the world at a very deep level for ourselves. But now we've got a proper public health crisis, which is tied up with your political identity in terms of how you behave, how compliant you are with the rules or a relaxation of the rules. And that's a new thing for me, at least. That's a new thing for me, that you've got a proper life and death, direct life and death situation that depends on not just your perceptions, your own perceptions of the risk, but also your political identity. And that's how that plays out, how those kind of very deep passions of self-preservation and concern for others plays out against the political identity is going to be really interesting over the next few months.
When you look at the data in the report, what you see is, you know, actually the political judgment is drawn out of a similar assessment of the risks. You know, so people are, I think the risk is roughly the same either side, but they just form different political conclusions to that. But both sides are misperceiving the risk. Both sides are inflating the risk in different ways. And so it's quite interesting. You have that sort of double layer of problem here. And what you've just described, I think, is quite worrying in a way, because I think naively I had in the early stages of this crisis thought, oh, we're getting a bit of a revenge of the facts here. You know, we had a post-truth era, but because science is so front and centre and the chief scientific advisor is now more powerful than the cabinet minister in the public eye, we're going to get back to some kind of analytical rigour. And this is a sort of a learning moment for politics, as that now seems to have gone. And you've written very well in your book about this issue of how bad we are at actually understanding risk and evaluating it.
The sense of risk is incredibly high, and too high relative to what we know so far. So one of the things that's in this study is that people think there's a 40% chance that they'll have to go to hospital if they catch coronavirus. And that's, as far as we can tell, that's way, way above what the actual rates are. So the imperial model that led to the shutdown assumed 4.4% based on Chinese data. So we've got 10 times nearly this view of risk of hospitalisation. As you say, that cuts across both the trusting and dissenting group. The only ones who get slightly closer are this group of frustrated people who are actually, so these people who are keen to relax the restrictions are actually closer to reality, but even they massively overestimate the risk of hospitalisation. So, I mean, like, the people's risk perception are classically bad because obviously if you've got this thing that's right in your face every day and everyone telling you, and you've got images of hospitals and terrible death tolls, you're going to inflate that risk in your head. I mean, we call it, it's called emotional innumeracy, in the sense of our views of our estimates of reality are much more emotional than we think they are. They're not a rational assessment of the facts. We overestimate what we worry about as much as worrying about what we overestimate.
There's two elements to this, aren't there? There's sort of the availability heuristic thing that has been written about, where if obviously the only news you see is about death and people going to hospital with the disease, you naturally inflate that. But also, as you say, the emotional bit of your brain animates your judgment in very powerful ways, more than the bit of your brain that does sort of careful, slow computation. It's been suggested, hasn't it, that there's almost an evolutionary aspect to this, that we're very hardwired to, if we see a saber-toothed tiger somewhere in the forest, to remember where that was and run like hell and in similar situations, whereas the statistical likelihood of encountering a saber-toothed tiger in the same place might be really low. But that's how our brains have developed. And you write about all these things in the book very well. And I wonder, though, whether since writing the book, you've sort of found any strategies for getting past this and communicating risk in a better way.
I mean, honestly, not really. I mean, I think this is, you're right, it's very hardwired. And the people who didn't take notice of the saber-toothed tiger were edited out of the gene pool. So they're kind of, we are at the end of a very long line of people who've done very well from inflating risks and being cautious, so that we've got that deep in us. And I mean, I think it is one of those ones where we know all the issues. We can give, fairly standard advice on, beware of your emotional reaction. Don't be drawn to vivid extreme examples. Try to control it. And you can do it to some degree if you've got it in your mind. And, Daniel Kahneman, when he talked about it, someone asked him about how do we get better, and he said, well, I've been studying this for 45 years and I'm not one bit better than when I started. And what he meant, though, it wasn't quite as gloomy as that, because what he meant was that you can't really at all control that system one fast thinking. It just happens, and you've got to, but what you can do if you work hard at it, is get your system two slower, more rational, contemplative thinking to kick in before you come to a view about things. But even that, he says, is really difficult to do. So, I mean, it's so embedded. And I mean, I think the thing that I tried to talk about in the book is that that interacts with the information that we get. So from the media, from social media, because the media and social media know that we like those vivid stories and that kind of thing that confirms our existing views. So we get more and more of it. And it creates this system of delusion between going back and forth between the media and how our and politics and how our brains work. And it's a very difficult cycle to break. I mean, even being aware that there's that cycle, people tend to focus on either we've got faulty brains or we've got a post-truth media and politics. And the reality is they're both two sides of the same coin, and they kind of feed off each other and create that environment.
How much of it is a sort of an accidental system that we've blundered into, and how much of it is cynical gaming of that phenomenon by political campaigns and candidates who know exactly what they're doing and can mobilise those forces very well?
The reality is a third option to those two of is it deliberate or is it accidental? I mean, I think the third way to think about it is it's inevitable. It's almost like natural law that it would happen like this. And the thing that looks really naive now is that we thought that the internet and our availability of information on the internet, when in the very early days, we thought this was going to be, you know, improve people's understanding of reality because all the truth would be out there. And it just is so naive now, looking back, that sense of where's the human in that? Where's the human characteristics of actually wanting to have all your existing views confirmed, having all these political strategies to affect other people? All of those such things were kind of, by some, were sort of ignored when it's an inevitable outcome that you get that type of natural bias within the system that is going to lead to that.
So give me some hope here. Well, what is an institutional environment in which you can overcome this? You mentioned Kahneman's distinction between system one and system two thinking, you know, between the sort of your caveman brain and your sort of wonky-ish, you know, big pointy-headed scientist brain. Where institutionally does one actually see the sort of the system two brain in operation in a way that, you know, where voters can activate that and make better choices, so to speak?
I'm not that pessimistic. I'm sort of more optimistic than pessimistic, in the sense of we've got all this going on, but we're no worse than on our understanding of reality than we were in 1940s America. We got similar questions that go back to that sort of era, and people were just as wrong back then as they are now. So this sense that we're utterly out of control in our views of reality is, it always feels like that, but it's not true. I mean, I think that the institutional thing that I think we are still underplaying the capabilities of a more deliberative approach to democracy, in the sense of citizens' assemblies, citizens' juries, getting real people involved in more detailed discussions and understanding of big issues, which I think is a really important thing, particularly potentially coming out of a crisis like this, is how to get people themselves involved in the process of how we recover could be as important as what we do to recover. Because I think that sense of disconnect between the people and politics is a big risk, and we have lots of potential in these more deliberative approaches to do more and involve people more. And my experience is when you see that, people are capable of setting aside their tribal identities, they don't completely upend their identity, but they can engage with particular issues in a better way, in a kind of more considered way than you would think from looking at extreme discussions on social media or in the media.
I'm fascinated by this concept of deliberative democracy. I don't have much experience of it myself, or having seen it. So, and I'm sure that'll be true of people listening to this podcast as well. So, Bobby, if you could just actually unpack in a second what you mean by that, that would probably help.
The best way to think about it is the parallel with legal juries in some ways. So you have a random selection of people who ordinary people who have, you know, an equal chance of taking part in this. And then they are given evidence from experts, but also allowed to discuss it, the issue among themselves over the course of quite a period of time. So it could be a day, a weekend, or it could be repeated over a longer period. So they have time with information that's kind of vetted as balanced on the issue. So you've got, that's really important. Make sure you're giving a full picture of things. And then they can ask questions of the experts, of each other, and then come to a view. I guess the key thing about it is, like a jury, it has to have some weight to it, has to have some consequence. So you have to give over power in some degree to the people who are going through the Citizens' Assembly or whatever the model that you are using. So you've got this group of people, which could be anything from, you know, 50 to several hundred people that have some influence over the outcome of this. And it's that sense of control that's really important. They have to be meaningful, or else it's just a talking shop for the public that can be ignored.
One of the most prominent examples of this was the referendum they had in the Republic of Ireland about abortion laws, which very obviously had the potential to be a hugely divisive, polarised. I mean, it involves religion, culture, generations, you know, everything. If you wanted to start a massive bin fire of culture war horrendousness, you'd have a referendum on abortion. And yet, through the use, as I understand it, maybe I'm being overly romantic about this, but through the use of citizens' assemblies and getting people in the room and really allowing ordinary people to be very prominent in terms of deciding who would be the witnesses, who would be the experts consulted, they got a very good, pretty good outcome, just in terms of, I'm not judging the result of the referendum, but it was a good outcome from my point of view on that too. But they didn't set the whole country on fire. And what was interesting is that no one even really at the top of British politics even thought to do anything like that on Brexit.
You need that combination of the correct cultural conditions, or, you know, public opinion conditions, where you can accept that. So it's not entirely down to the deliberative processes, but I'm sure that it was an important part of it. I mean, one of the things that we were sort of asked to look at post the referendum was, there was a lot of interest in the select committees and other political groups on, you know, could not just second referendum, but could we look at doing a big citizens' assembly? And given that prominence, this was before it was clear that we were leaving, but after the vote. And that would have been an awful context, though, I think, to try to introduce a deliberative event. So the context matters. So you can't just throw the worst problem that you have at a citizens' assembly or a similar sort of approach and say, sort that out for us. I mean, like, going back further, you know, instead of just having a vote, having a run-up before the vote in 2016 that was much more deliberative, much more national deliberative approaches, where people were given time to look at it. That would have been the way to do it. Is you have to get in first rather and have it as part of a program that's much more organized than just turn up and you've got to vote after a media frenzy for a few weeks in the campaign. And I think that's where the potential is, thinking ahead, exactly as you say. If we'd thought about it differently from the beginning, we could probably have had a different sort of conversation, maybe not a different result, but a different conversation with people.
As that suggests that, yeah, the important thing is as much how you frame the question as trying to get to an answer, and whether people have buy-in to the motive behind asking the question. Because you're absolutely right. I remember when there was a flicker of saying between 2016, the result, and 2020, the outcome, there were people saying, oh, maybe a citizens' assembly could help us out of this mess. And what happened was all the leavers said, well, the only people saying that are Remainers, because what they actually want is a different result, so we don't trust their motive. Plus a bunch of MPs saying, we have a citizens' assembly, it's called Parliament. And they mostly said it in that tone of voice, because they were mostly men saying it. That sort of sense of institutional jealousy of, you know, why should someone else arrogate the role to decide what we ask, combined with, yeah, we'd already set fire to the bin and it was burning, yeah, and the Citizens' Assembly isn't a hose that you can use to put a fire out.
Yes, no, exactly. So, yes, you would have just thrown deliberative democracy into that burning bin, I think, was my view at the time. Was you can't, it's not an extinguishing fluid. It would have been, it would have just burnt up, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, other people have different views, but I think you could have destroyed the future of deliberative democracy.
What's central then, if you want it to be a sort of for the, informing the fluid dynamics of democracy and not be lighter fluid on the flames of a culture war, to extend the metaphor way too far, what really matters is who are the sort of the trusted experts who are brought in? It's still, you know, you mentioned earlier that it's important that citizens are empowered to over the process and feel that they have real agency. But also, I mean, I know that you've looked at research going back over quite a long time in terms of who is actually trusted. And again, we have this perception, I think, is around that politicians are held in way less regard than they always used to be. Journalism, the same. Is that fair? To think that actually we've just the traditional message delivery people have lost credibility, and we need to look at a whole new set of people to, as it were, inform, educate and listen to the voters.
Yeah, not nearly as much as you would think from the way it's discussed. Because every week there's a new crisis of trust that someone says there is somewhere. And that's been like that for the last 20 years that I've been doing this. There's always a new crisis of trust. But when you look at the actual data, particularly in trust in politicians and trust in journalists, it's more or less flat on lots of measures in the UK. I mean, that's nothing to be proud of because it's quite a low level of trust, but it was a low level of trust in the early 1980s and even further back on similar sorts of questions. So this sense that it's all downhill on trust has a very naive view of the past, a kind of rosy retrospection view of the past that it used to be very trusting. There are definitely things that have gone downhill in terms of trust in the political process or political outcomes in Britain. So you've got long-term things that the sense that politicians are acting for the country and not themselves or their party, that has gone downhill in the past few decades. But it's nothing like the generalised sense of collapse of trust. I mean, I think all of the thinking on trust has moved on quite a bit from those days, because in some ways it is quite rational not to trust politicians to some degree. So, you know, Anora O'Neill and others talk about we should be focused on trustworthiness, who you're trusting to do what in what circumstances. And that is, trust naively given, as Anora would say, is just as bad as distrust. So we do have that sense of actually it's not as bad as it's people have the image in their mind, but it's still not great, and we have to do something to improve that relationship between people and politics.
What we're sort of, it seems to me, we're feeling our way towards is something that's in a distinction between healthy scepticism and jaundiced cynicism. So I think you're absolutely right that to note that the unhealthiness of naive trust in politics isn't that much better than corrosive mistrust. And actually, I think when people look back and imagine there was some golden age where politicians were doing their national duty and everyone accepted it, particularly in, for example, when people look at the war and the post-war period, there's been a lot of romanticising about the Blitz spirit and how everyone just pulled together. It was also a period of enormous deference and, you know, people simply didn't question the entitlement of a certain class of people to live a certain way. And in that case, if a Tory did the equivalent of, you know, lockdown in his castle or in his big country estate, actually it would have been less controversial because that's just the way the world worked. So that's a very long way of saying, yeah, the decline of deference and therefore people being interrogating their leaders a little bit more aggressive is a good thing. And then, but how do we understand the difference between that and something that just becomes a kind of nihilistic view that they're just all wicked people and you can't believe a word they say? And where are we now currently, do you, if you can estimate it, on that distinction?
Linking it back to the discussion that we had starting off, really, is the issue now is as much that polarisation and identity-driven view of trust. It's not, do I trust politicians? It is, do I trust my politician? And it's the same, to be honest, on science and other things. Now we've got much greater access to different scientific views. Some of them are utterly crackpot views. But when you look at trust in scientists now, people are increasingly thinking about, you know, my scientist who denies climate change or whatever else. And so it's kind of that sense of we got this more variable, richer choice of who to follow, who to believe, what information that we see. That's more of the risk to me than a generalized decline in trust or an increase in cynicism as opposed to skepticism.
That suggests that the task isn't, as it were, to rehabilitate the fact as something sacred that everyone can agree on, that we're beyond that now, but something that's actually more challenging, which is to extend understanding of what the scientific method actually is, which is recognizing uncertainty. So we're always aspiring to get to some scientific view, some factual position, but we need to always retain some awareness that it's not necessarily right. The difference that has been described between saying the science says this with a definite article, which is a very misleading way of talking about it, because there aren't many things where you can say the science is certain on this. You know, gravity is one, but you know, there aren't as many, you know, whereas how a virus works is we're not there yet. But that seems to be a much harder task, to sort of impart a collective ability to deal with uncertainty.
Yes, definitely. I mean, that's incredibly hard to get across to people. And it's like, do we really have the time and energy to do that as individuals getting on with our lives? I mean, like these tribal identities, these badges are shortcuts that take some of that away from us. So we got this sense of, you know, it's like a brand that means that you don't have to compare the product and features and prices of every single decision you make. You kind of follow a brand that shortcuts your decision. We are energy misers in terms of the effort that we put into things, quite rightly, because we've got lots and lots of things going on. So if there's these shortcuts that help us in politics, so I mean, the idea that we can get people to just be assessing all the scientific information or this, you know, this view from science and that view from science, or this view from, you know, social issues or political issues, is really tough and probably not the right thing for humans when we've got so many other things we could and probably should be doing.
Well, that leads us, sadly, because we're running out of time, into a really interesting whole new area of conversation, which is the danger that I think a lot of liberal-minded people and people on the sort of progressive and left side of politics, a trap they fall into, which is thinking that if you could just get a rational data set into people's brains, their politics would change. And people like Jonathan Haidt have written very well about this, that there's a whole other set of moral categories that people bring, about, you know, what is sacred to them, and ideas of honour and respect that are really core moral categories in our universe. And from what you've just said, I think, you know, that sense that if you have a candidate whose brand you've attached to, his or her notions of honour, what is sacred, chime with yours, and then that's a shortcut to belief and trust that your opponents will never get in, they'll never be able to break that down, or at least it's very hard for them to.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of evidence from historic studies across different sorts of countries that people's political views on particular issues follow their leader's views over time. So if you track it over time, it's not that the leader changes their views and then you assess it again, whether that's the right leader for me, and then make a choice. It is much more like the leader changes their views, or how they're expressing particular views on an issue, and then the people change views, some of the people change views to reflect the leader's change of view. So the kind of, it's an interaction between those, not mean that people are utter sheep at all and just follow along with the political brand. It does obviously change, people do switch around. But there is that element of stickiness to it, which is really important. And I think you're absolutely right. It's a really important point that the extent to which that is not, it's talking about it as a brand shortcut is probably belittles it a bit, because it is related to that underlying moral outlook or values-based outlook that we have. And those things are really important in politics, really important in policy making, to recognize that value position is real for people and relatively slow moving, but does inform a lot of our views of realities and what's the right thing to do.
Well, that actually connects to a conversation that Phil and I were having before you joined us, actually, at the recording the podcast earlier, about when the truth and lies or dishonesty, and a phenomenon that I've observed in the last few years, which is that when a candidate, when a politician, I'm thinking of Donald Trump, for example, says something that's sort of egregiously untrue, just really falsifiable, instead of that being an affront to his supporters and people thinking, hang on, well, that's not true, I will therefore reevaluate you as a politician, they think, well, the trust and the belief, the need to follow that person sort of forces them to accept the new reality and the untruth, which then binds them in tighter. Because once you've said, I have to accept the truth as whatever comes out of this person's mouth, it's almost like you're joining a cult and you're saying, well, now I've reoriented my moral universe to this person as the origin of truth. And in that way, bizarrely, telling lies is a very good way to win trust, if you see what I mean.
Like Donald Trump in 2016 just kept saying on the campaign trail seven or eight times, he just kept saying that the unemployment, I don't believe the unemployment rate figures in this country. They tell you it's about 8%, but it's like 40%, which was nonsense kind of like a really ridiculous reading of the data. But it wasn't his purpose. It was to tell those people who are in either unemployed themselves or in fragile employment, precarious employment, that he feels their pain and he's on their side. So that sense of using a distorted view of reality to express an emotion or emotional connection with people is absolutely core to that type of political communication and identification.
So bringing it back, because we are now out of time, I think, bringing it back to where we started, which is your research and the three categories we talked about of people in responding to the situation. That optimism I briefly had, that we were in a moment where a new kind of literacy around what is a fact would leave some lasting imprint, as opposed to what seems to be happening, which is the landscape is fixed and the waters of partisan identity just flow in and down the usual channels and rivulets off it goes. Having as someone who's followed opinion and these metrics for a long time, what's your sense about how impactful that window, just sort of basically March, April, May, is likely to be in terms of where we go forward from now?
Yeah, not massively in terms of that sense of now we've got a rational assessment of scientific facts, because it was kind of that moment will be looked back on as an incredibly rare and unusual moment of national unity, where we all agreed these are the things that we need to do right now. It wasn't particularly based on an assessment of the science, much more of an emotional reaction to this sense of threat and fear that something that we hadn't really encountered before. So that will look like a very incredibly unusual, historic, generational blip in how we relate to each other around these big crises. And then, because the normality has come back incredibly quick in terms of actually I'm on this side or I'm on that side. So I don't think it has shifted very much in those types of things, and including on trust in scientific information, all those different types of aspects of it. I think it has done some good in terms of making people aware of this scientific infrastructure, that we've got all these important people doing useful things to inform decision making. But the politics has reasserted itself really quickly.
As you might know, Bobby, from previous, if you've listened to previous episodes of this podcast, it's quite normal that we talk ourselves into quite a gloomy place on some of this stuff. So just if you can think of a way to give us a bit of hope and optimism.
I don't feel very pessimistic about it, even though I've got probably an optimism about this, because things, I mean, like, we are literally in this conversation and in how we talk about this more generally, we are always prey to the same sort of biases that the public are and everything else. So we've got this focus on negative information and this sense of rosy retrospection that it was worse in the past. And what I conclude in the book and all the things since is actually we've got to fight against that sense ourselves, because it isn't going down. Everything isn't going downhill. Everything is literally better than we think, because we're drawn to negative information. So in a very literal sense, it's better than we think. And keeping that in mind is, like, to be honest, for me, that's been the most important part and the greatest learning from doing all this type of stuff is just saying to yourself, you know, things are not as bad as they seem right now, and they're not going downhill, because everyone always thinks that all the time. And the reason that's important, and the reason I think, you know, all of those people who are trying to paint a more optimistic picture of the future is really important, is because you can talk yourself into this sense of spirals of decline, and how we talk about it, how we think about it, is just as important as what's happening. So I would say that the optimism, the cause for optimism and sense of positivity for now is real, and it's really important that we emphasize it, because it becomes an antidote to that self-fulfilling natural tendency to think everything is terrible and going downhill. So I mean, I'm optimistic genuinely, and I'm optimistic for a purpose, if you see what I mean. There's a purpose in being optimistic, which is to fight that tendency to go in the other direction.
And Bobby, can I ask you, do you still feel this way despite all of the uncertainties surrounding how we might emerge from this pandemic as a society?
That's a really good question. The next book I'm writing right now is on generational differences, what's real and what's made up about the difference between generations. And the reality here is that coronavirus is a generational event, as the sociologists who talk about generations meant, which is like utterly forms the reality and future for quite a big chunk of coming generations. So actually knowing what that means, we just don't know right now. If we pretend we know, we're kidding ourselves. This is a proper once in a generation or several generations event. And it could be absolutely awful, and it could be great, and a bounce back that allows us to do things very differently. And we really, really don't know right now. But it's going to be huge. I mean, it is going to be defining for decades for us in terms of the next. How does this impact on the coming generations? And I, you know, it's a terrible time to be writing a generational book, because I need to rewrite it all the time. But there is something remarkable is going to happen from it in either direction. We just don't know which yet.
Well, and interestingly, I mean, in terms of the question of risk management, the reality is, if you're over the age of 75, just the risk is so vastly different to if you're under the age of 30. I mean, people are having very, very different pandemics, not just in terms of their economic, cultural, ethnic profile, but age profile as well. And so that sense of coming out with some kind of national story of what the coronavirus meant for us, which is pronouns that people really want to use, is really going to be very difficult. And, well, as you say, it'll take a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So this has got so many generational and age-based effects. So the health effects are much greater on older groups, the economic effects will be felt much longer, and already the younger people are suffering more in terms of economic loss on job losses and other things. So, I mean, again, the main thing that I'm trying to keep on an optimistic note is that we always think there's going to be a generational war or conflict on the back of these types of things, that old versus young, and there's no sign of that. Again, I mean, this idea that was going to be peer-based, age group peer-based conflict between different groups is just, there's no sign of that. People's connections up and down the generational ranges are much stronger than their connections across. So we care about our grandparents, and our grandparents care about us. And it's that is really important to hold on to in this, is that no generational conflict, huge generational connection and care. And that needs to be reflected in how we approach coming out of the virus crisis and then the economic crisis that's going to follow.
I think that's a brilliant note to finish on, because it is nice and optimistic. And I think it gives us a moral duty to share this podcast far and wide, share it with your grandparents, share it with your grandchildren, and hopefully we can all be a bit more hopeful. I'm with you a little bit on, I'm capable of optimism when I remember that all the dials on every worthwhile metric of progress show that if you were to, it's like the sort of the Rawlsian veil of ignorance thing. If you could choose to be, to spontaneously appear as a child, as a newborn baby at any moment in history, anywhere in the world, you'd probably choose right here, right now.
Yeah.
Unless you're an Arsenal fan.
Gosh.
Really appreciate the time you've taken off. I know you're very busy with this report, but thank you very much indeed.
No problem.
If you would like more information about the King's College report we discussed today, or Bobby Duffy's book, that's all included in this week's show notes. Thank you to Out Yonder for the music and mixing, though any issues with sound all down to me. And on our next edition, we're very excited to announce that we have Helen Lewis, author of Difficult Women, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's presented the BBC's Week in Westminster, is a regular on Radio 4's News Quiz, and an occasional panellist on Have I Got News For You? And she is on the steering committee for the Reuters Institute for Journalism at Oxford University. So one of the many topics she'll be discussing with RAF is the failures of political journalism. Thanks for listening, and hope you tune in next week. Bye for now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.